Welcome to part one of my interview with sound healer and yoga instructor Kim Parker. She's local to me, and I've actually had a session with her that we talk about during the course of this section of the conversation. And yeah, this is a two-parter because, you know, I talk to people and we go long. So have fun, enjoy, and yeah. Welcome to Blue Lightning Healing Meditations. My name is Susie Parker Goins. My pronouns are she, her. I'm a channel, so I bring forward your guides so you can connect more easily with them, allowing you to have soul-deep conversations with them whenever you want. I'm an energy healer, a past life explorer, a mentor. My goal is to empower you by teaching you techniques that you can use on your own. We work together to find and identify the blockages to your growth and release them, inviting you to explore your possibilities. I'm available for phone and virtual sessions, and with Washington State opening up, I will be at some of these in-person events. The best way to contact me is through Susie@BlueLightningHealing.com. You can also contact me through my website, BlueLightningHealing.com. There you'll find links in a fully searchable database of my podcasts, a link for my Ko-fi.com account to support me in my efforts, and a full calendar of events so that you know where I'll be online and in person. Oh yeah, and the appointment scheduler. That's there too. Thanks so much. Blessings. Okay, welcome to Blue Lightning Healing Meditations. My name is Susie Parker Goins, and I'm a podcast host. La, 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 la. And I get to talk to amazing people. And today I have a newer friend in the, I don't want to say Susie universe, the Suze, never mind. In my sphere of influence, I am so happy to know people who are good at what they do. And I have a direct story. I have a direct response to Kim's work, but I have with me today, Kim Parker of Kim Parker Yoga. So please tell us what you do, Kim.
Thank you so much for having me today, Susie. My name is Kim Parker, and I own my own independent yoga studio at my home here in Lynnwood, Washington. And I specialize in a blend of three modalities: mindful movement, myofascial release work, and also sound meditation, which I think is what we're going to be diving into a little bit extra today.
Actually, hearing about these other two things, I'm making notes about them now. Myofascial release.
Yes, which is movement. Probably new since we saw each other, possibly.
Yeah. And then the sound healing. Okay. So yes, let's touch on the sound healing. Oh, no. Tell me more about your business.
Well, let's see. I've been operating as an independent teacher and studio for about going on 4 years now. We decided to make that move after we had our kiddo, who is 3.5 now. So yeah, it's probably been about 3 years in this space. Before that, I had a windy road that led me this way, I guess you could say. My very first experience with yoga was actually when I was about 16, and I found a VHS tape of Kathy Smith a la 1990 something in a white full body leotard.
The high cut ones or with the leg warmers. Oh my God.
That was my very first yoga that I ever did. And I was not a very like athletic or like physical kind of a kid. I was a bookworm, really into like school and band. Those are my things. And obviously the band stuff influenced the sound meditation, which we'll talk more about. But my first experience with any kind of mindful movement was this Kathy Smith VHS tape, which totally dates me.
and me, afterwards, because I knew what you were talking about.
Yeah, right. And afterwards I was like, whoa, I felt, not to sound totally corny, but I felt present in my body for the first time probably in my entire life, like to feel actually present in my body and to feel calm and focused and in my body at the same time. So that was when I was probably 16 or 17. And yeah, I've been through a lot of things since then, had a lot of different office type jobs, and always kept coming back to I really want to spend more time helping people, like actually interacting with people and helping people make some kind of positive impact, positive changes in their lives, something tangible that they can see and feel. And I knew in a lot of the office jobs I had, I was a helper role, but it was not usually it was not fulfilling in the way that I wanted it to be. See, I did my yoga teacher training first. No, I did my sound meditation training first. I lied. I did that first, followed by closely followed by my yoga teacher training. That was all around 2014, 2015. And then more recently did my myofascial release training. That was just before COVID. January okay. before COVID. So that okay. would have been whatever that was. Yeah,
cool. So mindful movement. I've not heard that term applied to yoga. Is that a new kind of
it's my words.
Okay. Okay. That's great.
It's so my words.
Say
because
TM or the C in the circle, whatever we need to do.
You know, I obviously incorporate a lot of yoga, like specific poses and breathing techniques that are yoga, but I also have played around with just moving mindfully, which may or may not be per se a yoga pose, but it's moving in your body in a way that you're really paying attention and you're present and you're aware of sensation. That's so important when we're working with anybody who's dealing with pain or injuries or illness, anything like that, to actually get ourselves back in our bodies so that we have that proprioception. The brain is aware of what the body is doing and they're talking to each other on the same wavelength.
Okay. Yeah. That sounds cool. Reconnecting with where you are in space. And oh, that's awesome.
There can be such a disconnect for folks if there is, especially any trauma or anything like that. Like we just, you know, there can be a disconnect. Things don't quite jive
right.
the way they used to, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
In layman's terms.
Yoga is, it's not just something one does in the class. They call it a practice, so you're working mm-hmm. on it all the time. But the expectation, which is what gets me hung up on it, is that you're expected to continue it on your own.
Meaning like the physical practice? Or...
Yeah.
So
like doing a sun salutation, I know what it is, but I don't remember what order. And so, but I understand some very dedicated practitioners will do that every day. And I don't remember the order in which it happens. Of course, I'm not able to go to a class all the time.
Sure. And here's where I like to, again, get into this mindful movement piece of things. Because yes, if we're being really orthodox about things, there's a proper sequence of poses to do in different yoga traditions, and there's more than one, and you know, I don't know them all. But at the end of the day, it's about moving and breathing mindfully in a way that helps to create space in your body, in your breath, in your mind, in your emotional landscape. So if that means, and I say this all the time in my classes, like I'll do a little flow or we do a couple poses and then I'll say, okay, do that flow a few more times with the pace of your own breath. And if you lose track of where you're going, just keep moving and breathing. Because at the end of the day, that's what it's all about. From my perspective and the work that I do with my clients is that this is about you getting in touch with your body in a way where you're meeting yourself wherever you are, whether that's sitting in a chair and doing chair yoga or roll around on the floor stretches or a full sun salutation sequence like you were just talking about. Different stuff for different folks. But as long as you're breathing and moving, you're helping to rebuild that connection between your brain and your body and your breath, which is so important for regulating the nervous system, and that just regulates everything else.
So it could be as simple as walking and
be as simple as paying attention to brushing your teeth, or when you sit down to a meal, taking a few deep belly breaths to actually ground yourself in, oh, this is what I'm doing right now. Because the definition, the very first yoga sutra in the Yoga Sutras, which is this, I'm going to get nerdy here for a second.
Sweet.
So the Yoga Sutras. And this might be totally off on a limb and not where we were going today, but hey, that's what editing is for. So,
but I'm usually the one who says that. Yeah, I'm usually the one who says that, but that's okay. But yeah, get yoga
So,
nerdy. Yeah, go.
yoga nerdy. The Yoga Sutras are this old text that codifies the principles of the yoga practice. And there's only one sutra in there that mentions asana, which is the physical poses of yoga. It is not like a guidebook of poses. That's not what the Yoga Sutras is. The Yoga Sutras is very much manual, I guess you could say, for stilling the fluctuations of the mind. That's the words that are used only in Sanskrit. It's the very first few Yoga Sutras say, now the practice of yoga begins. And that's seen as a very auspicious, like now the practice of yoga begins. Some people read it as now, comma, the practice of yoga begins. Some read it as now, colon, the practice of yoga begins. Like the practice of yoga is now. It's that presence, it's
Okay.
that paying attention, which doesn't have to be, you know, an eagle pose or a warrior two pose or standing on your head or anything like that. It can be, you know, sitting down to have your coffee in the morning and actually being present with yourself. Followed by the next sutra says the classical definition of yoga is the stilling of the fluctuations of the mind stuff. So if you were to picture a lake and that lake is your mind, the water can be still or it can be ripply or it can be choppy or you can throw rocks in it and it makes stuff over here or you can churn it up and then it's really mucky and you can't see the bottom. You know, the water quality can be different, but it's always, you know, this lake, right? And that's your
Yeah.
brain and that's your mind. And the Sanskrit word is vrittis, which I think is a fantastic word. And it means like little tornadoes, the little tornadoes, the little fluctuations of the mind, and that we're disturbed by these fluctuations of the mind. It's all of our thoughts, all of our interactions, all of the sensory input that we get through our eyes and our ears and everything else, everything that our brain is processing. It's all these little vrittis. And that's great. But if it's too much, or if it's too scattered, or if it's not clear, the water's not clear, we're not really seeing what's happening. We're not perceiving the lake, per se, as it truly is. We're seeing all the dirt and muck and everything else. We're not seeing clearly what's on the bottom. And that can be said for kind of our perspective in life, that when we have all the little chit chat up here,
Oh
right?
yeah.
It's like a snow on a TV back in the day.
Oh
You
my
know, when you turn the
God.
channel, you'd be between channels,
Yeah,
and
yeah.
it would
Oh yeah.
be. And then it's like that. And when we have that kind of muddiness in the
Yeah.
mind, it's hard to focus, it's hard to concentrate, it's hard to perceive things clearly. We often might perceive something as a threat that isn't a threat, or someone's judging when they're not, or we're judging and we don't think we're like all of these things because of the muck. And
So
so.
this won't be the first time I bring up the t-shirt, but I do have a shirt that says, wait, let me overthink this. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
All of the practices of yoga, the breathing, the poses, the meditation, everything is geared towards this overall objective of stilling the fluctuations of the mind stuff, of calming the little tornadoes in the mind so that we can have the space and the clarity to be fully present and to interact with ourselves, with other people, with our communities, with the earth, in a way that is compassionate, that is honest, and that sees clearly what is helpful and what is not, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it helps you let go of that which no longer serves you, or and
Scrub the
overthink.
window clean so you can actually see what's going on.
Yeah. Cool. Okay, so being in the body, I understand that being in one's body or grounded and centered is a big step. A lot of people have a problem trying to achieve that state. It's a moving meditation too. I love that concept. I can walk and go into a meditative state or dance or whatever sort of movement, and it can allow you to get that mind chatter out of the way, which I tell you can be such a persistent little bugger.
Oh yes.
Oh yeah.
Oh yes.
Yeah. So you're talking about stilling the mind, and it can be as simple as just sitting there with your cup of coffee. Now, there is a kind of yoga I've heard. Is it called nidra, where you just lay down? What is that called? Okay.
Yoga nidra or nidra, depending on who you talk to, is the yoga of sleep, the yoga of like conscious sleep, I guess you would say. I know a bit about the tradition. It is a meditation, so you are lying down traditionally. It's not a movement practice as far as what we might in the West perceive as a yoga practice, right? Something physical where you're doing stuff with your body. So it's more like a shavasana, which is the final resting pose in a yoga class where you flop down on your back and you just close your eyes and relax. It's that kind of a thing. You can lead it yourself if you know what the points are, or usually somebody else, the teacher, would guide it. It's a kind of a systematic, at least the one I'm thinking of, the 61-point yoga nidra, is a systematic kind of going through different points in the body to focus your awareness on that point and take like a breath of full awareness into that point and then moving to the next point. And it goes all the way from the crown of the head down into the chest, out into your tippy fingers and back in, and then down through the spine and down into the legs and the tips of the toes. So it's again, it's building that proprioception, that link between the brain and the nerves running to that part of the body that we're actually feeling it, noticing it, acknowledging sensation there. And then we're moving on to the next point, which sounds really kind of mundane, but it's very profound.
It is. No, in the meditations I write, I frequently have anybody who's listening go through. In the context of me doing the meditations, we're bringing Mother Earth energy up. But there are some meditations, like when the body scan one, where we're looking at the feet and we're looking at the ankles, and we take it bit by bit by bit, and breathing to bring attention, to draw one's attention to that spot, to release what's ever there. So I can see where that could be good. Is that kind of a trendy thing, or has that been around for a while?
No, it's been around for a while. I don't have a date off the top of my head. I haven't done intensives in yoga nidra per se, but I've taken, like, I've attended events with yoga nidra in them. That's been my experience for the most part. It's not a new age kind of a thing. It's something that has been around. It's an established branch of yoga.
Okay. Something like hot yoga, though, seems to me to be kind of trendy, but then
that is a trendy westernized thing. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Because sweating while I'm stretching is just not appealing to me. That's just me. Other people love it. I get it.
I know people who love it. I've never tried it myself. There are certain groups that I would not recommend it for, because you could really injure yourself because of the extra heat. But hot yoga does not exist in India, to my knowledge.
Okay.
That's an American thing.
So mudras, I have incorporated using the hand asanas in meditations with the chakra meditations. Am I being flippant when I say that's a form of yoga?
No, mantra is like yoga for your hands.
Yeah.
Yes, yes. So not flippant at all. It's kind of like a smaller version of bigger yoga poses, I guess you could say. Yeah.
Cool. And then you said you got your sound healing certification before you got the mindful movement, which I love that idea of, if you don't know where you're at, just keep moving. I love that. That's definitely
just keep
alley.
Moving and breathing. I tell people all the time, there's one rule in my class: you have to breathe. And if you don't, you've got bigger problems than me. Right? Telling you to breathe. Like, that is the one rule. And it's the one reminder that people need over and over again. And they're so appreciative. Like, I feel like a broken record sometimes for saying, and are we breathing? And take a deep breath. But every time people are like, oh my gosh, I wasn't breathing because I was focused and intended.
Yeah. You hold the breath, or you do a shallow chest breathing. And I focus a lot on the belly breath. And I know that's integral in what yoga I have done. It's like, that's really integral into making it work. You can breathe into a pose to make it to stretch further as you exhale and stuff like that.
And part of the magic behind that, Susie, is that deep belly breath is how we help to downregulate the nervous system.
Yeah.
I like to kind of unpack this sometimes for people, because
I was just writing about it today.
Cool.
Yeah. Sympathetic versus the parasympathetic. I was just writing that up. Yeah. So yeah, let's go there. Let's go there.
So, okay.
I know.
We will get to sound. I promise. We'll get to the sound stuff.
But we're pulling up our sleeves, talking about the sympathetic and parasympathetic. Yeah, baby.
Getting our tea, and here we go. So that deep belly breath is one of our most handy, accessible anytime tools for helping ourselves downregulate the nervous system. What does that mean? Calm the nervous system. Well, I don't feel stressed out or I'm not worked up. Well, you might not feel that way up here, but your body might still be experiencing the stress response. Because we experience so much stimulation these days in 21st century life. Like, there's just so much stuff that we're, so much information that we're taking in.
Yeah.
And so when we do start to switch gears from that sympathetic doing, active fight or flight, moving kind of gear, let's say, of the nervous system, when we take those deep belly breaths, we start to shift into more of a parasympathetic response, which is that rest, digest, restore response of the signals of what. So when the nervous system switches gears, that then triggers different hormone releases in the body that then has this cascade effect on our bodily functions, right? When we are in fight or flight, when we're geared up, breathing tends to be a little more shallow, a little more erratic, heartbeat goes up, blood pressure goes up, eyes get a little more focused because we're evolutionarily, like, think about back in the day, right? Way back in the day when there was a threat, like you had to run from the bears, right? To get away or like hide or fight. And so your body is responding to that and gearing up for that. And the hormones that are released gear you up for that. So when we switch gear from that more sympathetic activated state to parasympathetic, we kind of turn those extra hormones down, and then the heart rate starts to slow down. We start to maybe relax the muscles a little bit instead of them being tensed up and ready for action. We might even get like shuddery kind of movements as those hormones like continue to cycle through the body. It's a cascade effect of how it's physiologically affecting your body. It's not just in your head, right?
So it's absolutely physiological.
We think something is just in our head, and regardless of if something is real or not, the body can respond as if it is real. Whether it's real or perceived, can respond as if it was
In the room with you. And I understand this, the sympathetic system, it can be a habit and it could be triggered by even imagined or just thinking about something that could possibly happen. And you get into that fight or frozen feel. Then the breathing, it seems like the danger response versus that feeling safe response.
Yes.
And that I understand that would take practice for some folks who have experienced a lot, or I don't know if it's the right word, but chronic trauma to be continually in that. And so it is definitely, it can be a challenge to achieve that feeling of safety. That's part of what I do here, is to show people, to let people know how many options they have, what's available to them. There's no one right way to do this.
Yes.
Here's a great way. And now you're showing me there's no necessarily one right way to do yoga. You've
if
got
you're
all
breathing
kinds of
and you're paying attention to your body, I call that yoga.
Nice. I can do that. I can't touch my toes, but I sure can breathe.
Hey.
Part of my
not
job.
Required.
Part of my leveling up. I know there's so much more about yoga, and I don't know what to ask. I'm eager to move on to the sound healing, because I have personally experienced a sound healing session with you. A mutual friend said, oh, come on. And even her kid was there, you know, 6-year-old lying there. It's like, I've never seen you that still. And I was able to explain to you that I had a less than agreeable experience. Somebody said, oh, look, I got these new things, listen to them. And it kept going, was not being used in a therapeutic sense, in addition to whatever housing sound system they had going at the time. And it really just set me on edge and put me on guard. It put me into that fight or flight sort of thing with that. So I did not feel safe with that. So being able to come into you, and any practitioner ought to be willing and able to hear somebody's history. And if they're not willing to hear it, I'm not going to waste my time with them. But I was able to come into you and say, this is what's going on. And you were very receptive to it, sympathetic and compassionate about it. And being on the floor, I was like, I don't know. And you were ready. You were open to hearing how to help me up if I should need it. But we went through the process, and I'm proud I did not fall asleep and snore out loud, as I have been known to do. I stayed fully present the whole time. And then when it was done, I honestly don't remember if I felt any like cracks in the energy field or any sort of protective layers that I had on. But when it came time for me to get up off the floor, you were ready. You weren't pushy about it, but you gave me the space. And yes, angels sang as I was able to get up on my own, get up off the floor on my own. And that was my new trick. I actually wore myself out to needing a nap the next time I went to our school library. It's like, no, look at me. And I would do it like 4 or 5 times. And, you know, these were people who understood what my physical limitations had been. So they were all duly impressed. But, you know, at the end of the day, I had to take a nap in the car because that was more exertion than I experienced for a long time.
Done that for a while.
And it has maintained. So if we could get into the theory of sound healing, I think that's a great jumping off point for me, because I know we all work on frequencies and life is vibration and energy and all that. But how does sound healing fit into that?
I always love hearing your story. Anytime someone reminds me of your story, I always want to put a disclaimer of like unusual results or not unusual, but I can't think of the right words.
Oh my God, I almost spit
you know,
on
results
my water
are
out.
Atypical.
Your mileage guarantee. May vary.
exactly, yeah. Right? That kind of a thing. Because I don't by any stretch of the imagination have a magic wand that I, you know, can wave like, with my sound mallets. I'm not, you know, waving a magic wand and then ta-da, you can stand up. It doesn't work like that for me at all.
But this was a great confluence of circumstances. I was ready for it. You were there. I felt safe. Mm-hmm. You were ready. I'll say that a few times. So that was like that perfect, not storm, but it was a confluence of circumstances where it did work. And there are times, I think I will interject this too. Like if somebody feels like, well, that healer's not helping me, it's so multi-layered there. It's like, are you ready to hear this? Are you ready to do the things? Is the healer in a place where they are giving you that resonant information? Because I've had those people asking questions and they're like Wonder Woman with her bracelets of whatever it is, you know, just deflecting everything I'm saying. But what about this? But the thing is, my least favorite phrase, the healing does look miraculous when everybody's at the right space, sharing that intention and working together and putting in that energy into it. Okay, so now.
So sound healing. What is the deal with sound healing? What is sound meditation? What is this crazy stuff that we're talking about? There are different tools that can be used. I use Himalayan singing bowls. There are also crystal singing bowls. I believe similar ideas of how to play them, but I'm not certified in the crystal, so I can't speak for that.
So what are the Himalayan singing bowls made from?
The Himalayan singing bowls are a blend of 7 metals, and they're hand. The ones that I have are made traditionally, so they're hand hammered into the bowl shape. There's also nowadays you can get them cast from a mold as well. So I can speak to the Himalayan tradition that I was trained in. So we play traditionally 7 bowls arranged in a circle, and that's 7 different pitches or notes if you're a musician that basically make up a whole scale. So that's how we set things up.
Is it the same most scale? Of the work... excuse me. Is it the same notes, or you said according to scale? And so like C, D, B, whatever. It's been so long. It's not just a series of 7 ever. It's a series of 7 in a particular set, but there are multiple sets.
In a particular scale. Yeah.
Okay.
But you can find bowls in every pitch, sharps, flats, every, you know, all of them. But for a set of 7, you need to have them in a scale because the theory, I guess, behind the sound healing is that when we play the bowls in certain patterns with certain intervals, that are soothing, that helps to get that parasympathetic response on board. Okay, so we were talking about that a moment ago, that rest, digest, restore. Also, talking about frequencies, we have brain waves, right, that we can't see. I mean, unless you're in machines that scan these things. And there's the theory of brain entrainment around sound healing as well, that as we're playing the bowls in these certain intervals, we're helping to drop the brain out of like active brain wave status down into like maybe resting or even meditative brain wave frequencies. And that's where I was looking for my notes so I would have my numbers of my hertz and all that stuff handy. And I can't find my darn notes.
Yeah, no worries about that.
But the idea is that there are brainwave status that is, you know, active, right? When we're awake and we're alert and we're doing stuff. And then there's brainwave that we drop down into things that are a little more restful, maybe even meditative, or that creative flow. If anybody's ever experienced that like creative flow where you're just in something and you're just like focused on it and it comes easily. And then all the way down into like deep sleep brainwaves, right? So we've got all these different levels per se of brainwaves.
I want to do a little sound healing for dummies here. It's not that you are chiming on them, like bonging them like a bell, right? So when you're talking intervals, I understand that's the space between the tones. So C versus F or whatever. And then you're not tapping on them, right?
There's a few ways that we can play the bowls. So there's a couple different kinds of mallets and a couple different techniques for playing the bowls. There's a mallet that kind of looks like it's got like a big soft thing on the head of it, right? And those we can use to dong, I call it dong the bowl.
Okay.
Where it makes kind of a gongy sound. So it's not like a bang, but it's kind of a bong kind of a sound.
Okay. It's got softer edges around it.
Softer edges around the sound.
Okay.
We also have these mallets that are harder. They have more of a cylindrical shape at the top, and they're covered in felt usually, or leather, minor felt. And it's a harder mallet than the first one. This one we can use to tap the edge of the bowl, which makes a little more of a bell chimey sound. So it's not a bong, it's more of a bing, if you will. And we can use that same tool to also roll it around, rub it around the edge of the bowl, as if picture like somebody with a wine glass and they dip their finger in the wine glass and they rub it around the edge of the wine glass and it makes a sound. Picture that, but with a mallet being rubbed around the edge of the bowl. And that is the cool sound, I think. That's the sound that feels like it's coming out of the earth, because the resonance builds slowly. And so you don't really hear it at first, you feel it. You feel the vibration first. And then, so if you're lying on the ground, for instance, you might feel it through the ground a little bit. And then you might start to feel it through the air a little bit. And then the tone, the actual sound starts to come to life and you hear that it kind of fills up the space. It gets broader and bigger. So you're experiencing the sound not just as an ear, you know, thing,
right,
as a hearing experience. You're also feeling the sound as resonance, as vibration, which is pretty stinking cool.
Yeah, it is, because I think you had some above our heads, and I think maybe you place them on the body.
Uh-huh.
You have been known to do
sound massage placed on the body. Yep.
Oh, when you call it that, I'm
sound
massage. Yeah. Yeah.
Sign me up for that.
Exactly.
So those are the different techniques for creating sound with the bowls. Thank you for asking that question, because that would not be clear to somebody who has never.
Yeah. Okay. So now we can go back. We can, there was some sort of groovy word I could use, but now we can play back into the frequency and the theory behind it.
Yes. So going back to kind of the theory, I was a band geek growing up. So I came into the bowls partly because I love music, and I've always felt that music is so much more than notes on a page, that sounds have the ability to shift our moods, to express emotions, or to help us move through emotions. And part of that is based off of intervals. music theory 101 here. There are intervals, which means two notes played next to each other. There are some that sound happy. We call them major. There are some that sound sad. We call those minor. There are some that sound kind of angry or fearful. Those are usually your augmented and diminished, which we don't need to get into. But the ones that we use in singing bowls are the perfect fourths and perfect fifths. Those are the ones that play when the clouds part and the sun shines through. Ah, like that is, those are the perfect fourths and the perfect fifths. Okay. Those are the most pleasing intervals to the human brain. We all figured this out in music theory in the West, you know, after pianos and all this business, but way out in the East, they were ding-donging on these bowls way back before the first piano was made, and they figured out that these intervals were the most pleasing, the most relaxing, the most soothing, like that was the effect of these intervals, right? And so that's what the tradition that I'm trained in is kind of built around something called the relaxation protocol. Or the relaxation sheet music, I guess you could say.
Okay.
And those are the patterns that we use. And that's why it helps people relax, is because we're working within those intervals. Now, if you had experienced a sound session earlier that did not work with that awareness of intervals and how they work together, you could have been experiencing sound that was a bunch of augmented or diminished intervals or a bunch of minor intervals, and then it would make you feel all kinds of other feelings as opposed to peaceful or soothing or safe.
So could it be in the manufacture of a bowl, like, you know, slightly imperfect? Mm-hmm. Is that going to have, I understand your focus is on the Himalayan bowls, which are made of the seven metals, but there are crystal ones that this person was saying, yeah, they're slightly imperfect. And I don't know if there were so many reasons that session didn't work because it wasn't a session. But is sure. Is that something to consider when one is looking for a bowl? I mean, I don't think I would go out and buy bowls just for me. It would, somebody else can have that, that vocation. But, you know, when you're looking at that, would that make a difference?
Quality does make a difference. I'll tell you what, when I first thought I was going to get into sound bowl stuff, I tried, this is kind of embarrassing, I tried ordering a set of bowls from Amazon.
Oh my God.
Because it was such a good deal. And they arrived and I tried playing them and I was like, oh dear Lord, they sounded horrible together because they were not pitched right. So they didn't work well together as a set. And the bowls just didn't have a great sound to them. I guess you could liken it to, you know, different types of guitars sound a little bit different, or trumpets or any musical instrument, right? There's going to be levels of quality and you're going to get a better or different quality of sound, you know, as you move up in quality. So yeah, those went back. And then I spent a long day in Seattle hopping between two different shops and ring-a-dinging like every bowl in those shops to create my own set.
Ah.
So I handpicked all seven of my bowls and they play well together. It wasn't about finding like a perfect scale per se, or I didn't go into it going like, I want these notes for this scale. That's not what it was about. It was about finding a couple of good bowls that were kind of the starters and then building the rest of the intervals around that. Much better quality bowls. Are they imperfect? Sure, they're hand hammered, but the tones are clear. They work well together. The intervals are clear when they're played together, and that therefore gets the results that we're looking for. Because,
okay, so it just occurred to me that as I bring energy through to help somebody else, I get benefit from it too. Is it safe to assume that that's what happens to you, that you found these bowls that will work on you in addition to the people you're working on?
I suppose that could be possible. Yeah. Yeah. That they resonated with me. No pun intended.
Okay. Point one, you get that point. Okay.
They resonated with me, and therefore I was a clarinetist before I was a sound bowl person. I remember in college when I was looking to upgrade my mouthpiece for my clarinet. Couldn't afford to upgrade the whole clarinet to a professional model, but I was going to upgrade a mouthpiece. And I tried like, I don't know, maybe five that were created by the same guy, and they were technically the same model of mouthpiece, but every one was a little bit different.
Yeah.
I found the one that I liked the best that was resonated with me and with my instrument and with everything else that I had going on. And that was the best one for me in my setup. Was it technically the same as the other four in the package? Sure, but not really because they're handmade.
Yeah.
And I think that's true for any instrument. So yeah, these ones resonate with me. And so far it seems like they're doing good work for other people too. We vibe together, me and my bowls. Not to sound too hippy dippy here, but we're on the same wavelength. Oh man, I am full of the jokes now.
I was about to degenerate into the 12-year-old humor. Your bowls, yes. Do you have to hold your bowls? Yeah, those aren't going to work so well. That's okay. Okay. So do I have any other questions? Do you have any other things to tell me about sound healing? This is as good a place as any to take a break in this interview. When I asked her if she had anything else to say, usually that's used as a ending point. Well, no, we went on for another half an hour. So stay tuned for the second part of the interview with Kim Parker. And until next time, blessings.